My name is Dina Stewart, and I'm 17 years old. I developed epilepsy, and one of my relatives put in a request for me for Make-A-Wish. My wish was to make a CD of the songs that I have written. It was amazing. I looked past anything that was wrong, and I just sang. Make-A-Wish is about dreams coming true.
If you know a child who needs our help, please visit us at wish.org and share the power of a wish.
Live 365. News service of the Israeli intelligence apparatus, which described the entire propaganda effort with respect to preparing this war of total destruction in Iraq as a pea soup of deception.
On Saturday, August 23rd, while President Bush was on vacation in Crawford, Texas, he is concerned about the counterattack, really, the people like James Baker, Brent Scowcroft, Henry Kissinger,
Lawrence Eagleburger, Madeleine Albright, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Norman Schwarzkopf, Dick Arney, a who's who of the dominant ruling class in the United States, mobilizing against a part of their own.
Basically, what they were saying, that the Bush, Vice President Cheney, Richard Pearl,
Armitage, Rumsfeld, what could be called the Mossad wing of the ruling class,
were recklessly endangering the ruling class in the United States. Not that they had any basic disagreement with an invasion of Iraq, with an attack on Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi people, but that the way that President Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld were going about it was dangerous, devious, as Lawrence Eagleburger stated.
Now, Eagleburger, Maya, is the former Secretary of State who, in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, went on the airwaves to insist upon the necessity of using the opportunity of the attack of September 11th to destroy this regime of Saddam Hussein and to take control over the oil of Iraq.
So today we are going to go into the nature of the debate. What is the cost of war? And also how the U.S. ruling class intends to carry out the escalating invasion.
And so, Maya, I just want to say this. When we use the term ruling class, I'm sorry, I think it's important for us to point out that this is not a matter of political rhetoric or of swear words. It's a precise description of what has been documented overwhelmingly by the U.S. Department of Commerce and by sociologists across this country is a very concentrated oligarchy. The New York Times and the Department of Commerce talk of 2% that own 90% of the national wealth. The former head of Avis and American Express, Robert Townsend, speaks of 5,000 people who control what he calls the commanding heights of the U.S. economy. They are in command of the banking and corporate apparatus. They put their functionaries and bureaucrats and administrators in the enforcement arm, the intelligence apparatus. It's an enormously concentrated sector and structure of power, corporate capitalism, banking capital. It is a ruling class, and it defines American reality. It informs all of these political discussions and debates and strategies because it's about preserving their rule and maintaining their domination over the world's resources and the continued demand for ever-increasing supplies of cheap labor, exploitable labor. It creates mass poverty. It creates the conditions of immiseration that affects over 2 billion people on a daily basis, living at roughly a dollar a day, no potable water, a rampant epidemic disease. That defines the reality of the ruling class. The war in Iraq, the constant seeking of the destruction of any resistance to their designs, is the inevitable and necessary and continued activity of our ruling class. The debates we discuss are within the framework of strategy amongst the rulers about how to enforce their rule effectively and how to subdue our own people in relation to that project.
Last Wednesday, from his ranch in Crawford, Texas, President Bush came out and said that there had been intense speculation that there was going to be a potential attack. Quote, "It's kind of a churning," Bush said, as Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was at his side, and he moved forward to the microphone and interjected, "A frenzy." That was Rumsfeld calling what he said the media was creating a frenzy. And this was reported in the Los Angeles Times as the headline, "Bush Strikes a Cautious Note on Iraq," and that the president and his aides had criticized the media for a frenzy over the idea of hitting Saddam Hussein. And then on Saturday, in the Los Angeles Times again, the headline read, "Iraq talk spins out of control." And they had a White House official saying that the debate presumed that, quote, "We're ready to launch coordinated action against Iraq, but we're not." And it goes on, "There will be more consultation and more debate before any action is taken." Yet, as we have been reporting on the, over the past 2 weeks, the invasion has begun. It is no longer flybys in the north and the south. There is an intensification. There is a creation of a large military force of over 100,000 troops in the Middle East. And then, after these statements in the Los Angeles Times this past Saturday, on Sunday, British and U.S. war planes leaving from Kuwait attacked in Basra, 343 miles south of Baghdad. They attacked bombing targets in southern Iraq. The Iraqi radar caught this, and the 35 sorties, that means 35 bombing raids, were in against Iraq. And if that weren't enough, then on Monday, the day after, again, U.S. and British warplanes leaving from Kuwait attacked Bitera in Maysan province, only 183 miles south of Baghdad.
And as the DEPCA documentation that we've been discussing over the past several weeks in the Peace Soup of Deception makes clear, U.S. Special Forces are already in place in Kurdistan and in Turkoman areas where the oil is concentrated around Mosul and Kirkuk. And at the same time, these air raids are focused on the on airfields that the Iraqis could use for their own defense, as they are in the Shiite areas of the south, the areas of the Marsh Arabs, the 60% of Iraq's population, which the U.S. is singling out for constant bombing targeting, squeezing the regime of Saddam Hussein in a pincer from the north and the south, effectively isolating its ability to maintain any kind of administrative control over the majority areas. The mass of the country is being taken away from their safe and continuous control. This is a pincer operation. It is a war in progress, and it is preparatory for the next steps. It's only a debate about how to conduct those next steps that divides sectors of the ruling class, partly because the strategic objectives of Sharon, of Perez, of the Mossad apparatus, the Likud apparatus within the ruling class, the Pearls, the Armitages, the Cheneys, and the Rumsfelds, are engaged in implementing the plan of Oded Yinon of the 1980s of fragmenting each Arab country in turn into its ethnic components. And there is a significant sector of the dominant sector of the ruling class, the dominant component of the ruling class, that is linked to the Saudi ruling family, to the oil-producing countries whose feudal elites dominate in the Gulf and in Kuwait, and who are concerned about the Israeli perspective of total fragmentation for fear of their inability to control the outcome, for fear of the unleashing of forces that they will never be able to contain, for fear that it will require the kind of perpetual occupation by U.S. forces of which they speak that will never be sustained without resistance and will never be permitted by the American people themselves. Their ultimate fear is our own people.
And this is articulated quite well by Brent Scowcroft, who had been the National Security Advisor for President George W. Bush's father, George Bush Sr., and James Baker, who had been the Secretary of State for George Bush Sr. These are George Bush Sr.'s closest confidants and spokespersons, and over the past couple of weeks, they have come out with the clearest articulation of how they think an attack on Saddam Hussein should be unfold. But to go back to George Bush Jr., George W. Bush, who, as you will recall, in West Point on June 1st, laid out the strategy for the United States of preemptive strike. That is, without the U.S. Having even a so-called attack upon it, that the U.S. could take charge and go into any country in the world militarily. As he had said, quote, "We must take the battle to the enemy, disrupt his plans, and confront the worst threats before they emerge. In the world we have entered, the only path to safety is the path of action." And then he went on to say, quote, "to be ready for preemptive action when necessary to defend our liberty and to defend our lives." Now, this is the approach that he has sent out for Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld. And be clear, we don't think it was President Bush himself who came up with this strategy, but it would have been Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney.
Now, Mortimer Snerd is not the initiator of these policies, as the members of the ruling class have themselves constantly made clear, but these puppeteers have always a public relations figure. It doesn't matter what the nominal holder of office in the presidency is. They are basically PR people who give a rhetorical support for the designs that are handed to them and which they then promote, whether it's Reagan or Carter or Clinton or Bush, senior or junior. It's the same scenario. It's the same basic pattern of control, which they reflect as mouthpieces.
Then on July 19th, President Bush, speaking at Fort Drum in New York, Upper New York State, near Lake Ontario, a major training base in for the U.S. Armed Forces, he stated, quote, "to ignore this mounting danger is to invite it. America must act against these terrible threats before they're fully formed." And then he sent Condoleezza Rice, National Security Advisor, to Great Britain to shore up Tony Blair and the Labour Party, because Tony Blair, the Prime Minister of England, is being attacked by the members of his own Labour Party, who actually even are planning an anti-war rally prior to the Labour Party Congress. And what Condoleezza Rice stated to the BBC in an interview on August 15th, quote, "we certainly do not have the luxury of doing nothing." And then she referred to World War II and the appeasement policy of Neville Chamberlain. And she continued with, quote, "we just have to look back and ask how many dictators who end up being a tremendous global threat and killing thousands and indeed millions of people should we have stopped in their tracks." Again, we have Condoleezza Rice with the call for the preemptive strike, and President Bush, and now in the recent days, Vice President Dick Cheney taking up the call.
Maya Darlene Superville in the Associated Press on the 23rd quoted both Bush and Cheney as and Rumsfeld as referring to Saddam Hussein as an Adolf Hitler. Condoleezza Rice again invoking the same rhetoric, demonizing Saddam Hussein as a Hitler who could be stopped from engaging in mass murder by preemptive action. It should be mentioned that is precisely the rhetoric that was used by George Bush Sr. at the advent of the Gulf War. So they demonized Saddam Hussein in order to legitimize their own aggressive designs, but the difference has to do with their strategic concerns. Because one of the elements here is illuminated by the role of Lauren Mrozovic of the Rand Corporation, who was brought on board for the Defense Policy Board and linked Saudi Arabia to the, quote, terrorist groups, called it the kernel of evil, the prime mover, the most dangerous opponent in the Middle East. And the Washington Post revealed that this briefing had taken place in which Mrozovic literally exposed the fact that the intention was, after Iraq, to dismantle the apparatus of regime in Saudi Arabia itself. And they invoked Seymour Hersh's description of Saudi Arabia as the prime progenitor of terror in the world. And it is this that Scowcroft reacts to when he says that the policies of Bush Jr. and of his cohorts are endangering the war against terrorism, by which he means they will destabilize in a reckless manner the apparatus of client regimes which has maintained the status quo over generations for the U.S. rulers.
So that really leads us into the actual opinion pieces that first were put out by Brent Scowcroft in the Wall Street Journal on August 15th, and then by James Baker when Bush Jr. didn't respond, didn't take up the fact that what Scowcroft was doing was a real signal. And so James Baker this past Sunday in the New York Times had an extensive opinion piece. So to go to the Brent Scowcroft piece of August 15th, which was appeared in the Wall Street Journal. And he again says, quote, "Our nation is presently engaged in a debate about whether to launch a war against Iraq." And he then says later, "It's beyond dispute that Saddam Hussein is a menace. We will all be better off when he is gone." So the issue is, and the subhead is, think carefully. Because it is revealed here, as Ralph was saying, what Scowcroft is signaling. And the signal is that, as he says, make no mistake. We simply cannot win that war without enthusiastic international cooperation, especially on intelligence. And what he also says is that if there is an attack on Iraq, it could provoke Israel to respond, quote, perhaps with nuclear weapons, unleashing an Armageddon in the Middle East. Finally, if we are to achieve our strategic objectives in Iraq, a military campaign very likely would have to be followed by a large-scale, long-term military occupation. And as you know, we have mentioned that that occupation could be as many as 70,000 troops.
Well, Maya,
and yes, about the destabilization, what Scowcroft goes on to say is, quote, "Even without Israeli involvement, the results could well destabilize Arab regimes in the region." And that is the real issue for the Scowcroft, Baker, and Eagleburger wing. And make no mistake, Eagleburger is a close associate of Vice President Dick Cheney. And it was Dick Cheney who put Lawrence Eagleburger on the board of directors of Halliburton.
So this is a debate between elements of the ruling class about the appropriate strategy for implementing their designs. Top U.S. general attacks hawk strategy on Iraq, is the article by David Rennie in the the Telegraph in London on August 23rd, General James L. Jones, the four-star commander of the Marine Corps, who is taking over as NATO's supreme allied commander, addressed high-ranking conservatives in and around the Pentagon, who have demanded a short, sharp attack on Iraq using high-tech weapons and airstrikes. Jones told the Washington Times it is not sufficient to copy Afghanistan tactics. America would have to build up huge conventional forces if it wanted to be certain of success. Quote, Afghanistan was Afghanistan, Iraq is Iraq. It would be foolish if you were ever committed to going into Iraq to think that the principles that were successful in Afghanistan would be successful in Iraq. And Jones, but as the Telegraph describes, the latest in a succession of prominent American military and political figures to issue warnings about the danger of rushing headlong into war, states, you better have Plan B in your hip pocket. Because when you attack someone who has any kind of well-trained army on their homeland, they are going to fight differently than if you engage them in Kuwait. So this, as the article says, the debate is as much ideological as strategic. High-profile conservatives led by Defense Secretary Rumsfeld see it as their mission to wean the top brass from their love of huge armies and heavy weaponry. But senior generals, Vietnam veterans, have proved more cautious, pushing for an overwhelming force of hundreds of thousands of troops in an operation akin to the 1991 Gulf War. The Pentagon's key figure, on Iraq, General Tommy Franks, has come up with a compromise battle plan. But this, then, is the framing of these debates. And George Hunsaker, in The Christian Century, outlines what they're arguing about. Quote, according to some estimates, 250,000 U.S. troops are needed, but others are estimates are lower. A Pentagon study has projected as an acceptable death rate 20 to 30,000 U.S. soldiers. The number of acceptable Iraqi deaths is not calculated. And so we have a debate about how effectively to destroy the regime without destabilizing the client states in the region.
And so we have James Baker III writing in the New York Times Week in Review this past Sunday, August 25th. And you can still see this on the internet at www.nytimes.com. And he's writing from his vacation resort in Indale, Wyoming. And the title is, quote, The Right Way to Change a Regime. And so, again, as we said, as Baker said, the ruling class is determined to topple Saddam Hussein, to have control, direct control of Iraq through a reliable client regime, when they no longer think that Saddam Hussein is a reliant regime for them, even though they were the instruments to put Saddam Hussein in place. So he says, quote, we owe it to our children and grandchildren to do so. That is to topple what he says rogues like Saddam Hussein. He says, but we must continue to be an important foreign, and this must continue to be an important foreign policy priority for America. But he points out the only realistic way to effect regime change in Iraq is through the application of military force, including sufficient ground troops to occupy the country, including Baghdad, depose the current leadership, and install a successor government. And this is what Ralph was referring to when he was talking about the use of massive troops, and that means the body bags coming back to the United States. They're trying to get everyone ready for that. But as Baker says, it cannot be done on the cheap. Now, that's a direct quote. He continues, it will require substantial forces and substantial time to put these forces in place to move. We had over 500,000 Americans and more soldiers from our allies for the Persian Gulf War. There will be casualties, probably quite a few more than in that war, since the Iraqis will be fighting to defend their homeland.
Eagleburger said, that he doubted the evidence that the Iraqis have or are able to use weapons of mass destruction. I don't know why we have to do this invasion now when all our allies are opposed to it. Scowcroft asked that they think again and made what was called an extraordinary challenge to the Bush administration. And perhaps most interesting and illuminating are the remarks of that time-honored prostitute of American rulers, Henry Kissinger, who made the following comments. According to Henry Kissinger, this is a report in Reuters by Alan Eisner, the approach of the Bush administration right now challenges an international system established by the 1648 Treaty of Westphalia, which laid down the principle of non-intervention in the domestic affairs of other states. Now, this is very interesting to note. Henry Kissinger invoking the international system. As Gore Vidal once said in another context, it gives hypocrisy a bad name. There has been no instance in which from Cambodia to Grenada to Panama, to virtually every arena where American ruling class interests are involved, in which the U.S. Has not acted to breach sovereignty and to destroy on the ground the leaders and the members of popular movements of opposition to U.S. control.
And this brings up the method that Brent Scowcroft and James Baker, the methodology, the way to go, the way forward that they see, because not only do they acknowledge it will take massive U.S. troops, but the Gulf War cost $60 billion, most of which was paid by the U.S. allies, particularly Saudi Arabia. And they anticipate that this war will cost $60 to $100 billion, and if the U.S. goes it alone, that will be borne by the people of the United States at a moment which will lead, they expect, to a collapse of the economy. So what does Brent Scowcroft?
Well, they're worried about oil prices going up to $100 a barrel. They're worried about the resistance of the population, destroying the pipelines and the oil fields in Saudi Arabia and in the Gulf and in Kuwait. They're worried about doing this without sufficient support from their subordinate European regimes and from their client states in the Arab East. Madeleine Albright, of all people, made the following statement. Iraq is not a direct threat to the United States, which is why we need to have a discussion about whether we will be better off with an attack or preemptive attack on Iraq from where we are now. Iraq and Saddam Hussein are pretty well contained within the sanctions box, said she. Now, Kissinger invoked the following sentiment. Iraq, he said, continues to threaten the United States by its capacity to threaten its neighbors, and he does not rule out preemptive strikes, but he says you can't do this without a large apparatus of support within the structures of rule in Europe and in the Arab East itself.
And Ralph, just in anticipation of all the of the escalated war on Iraq, oil prices have risen already to $30 a barrel. And previously, they had been at all-time low prices,
and
which...
Yes, Maya, that's absolutely correct. And the consequences of a vast increase of oil prices, the immediate consequences, are enrichment of the oil company execs, but a very severe devastation of the value of the dollar. And, of course, from the perspective of the European countries who are utterly dependent on this Middle Eastern oil, a wrecking of their economies, a consequence, a ripple effect in the economies of the ruling of the capitalist ruling class that have consequences they cannot fully anticipate and control. It's interesting to note that, of all people, Madeleine Albright, who not just was the primary promoter of the sanction regime administered by the United Nations, but when confronted in 1996 by Leslie Stahl on CBS as to whether the price was worth it, When the reports came that over 500,000 Iraqi children had been, quote, killed off by sanctions, unquote, her response was to say, and by the way, at the same time, that the reports from the UN indicated that the 4,000 a month were dying, this is speaking of the children in Iraq, from the sanctions regime, and she said it was well worth it, quote unquote. It was well worth it. It is well worth it. Over a half million children killed, and Clinton, Secretary of State, it was well worth it. These are the people who are now posing challenge to the immediate attack on Iraq by the Mossad wing of the ruling class in the United States.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. So let all your friends, family, and colleagues throughout the United States and internationally know that they too can listen to Taking Aim on the internet. Now, you can reach us. We have a new email to make it easier for you. Our new email address is takingaim@pacbell.net. That's takingaim@pacbell, PACBELL.net. And you can write to us by U.S. Post Office at Taking Aim or Veritas Press at P.O. Box 6345 Vallejo, California. That's V-A-L-L-E-J-O, California, 94591. And we have available Iraq and Kuwait, a history suppressed, a pamphlet of an extended pamphlet that goes into the background of the Gulf War, the impact of the Gulf War, and will give you much insight about the invasion of Iraq that is taking place.
And actually, Maya does address as well the overriding concerns of U.S. rulers to provide the pretext for intervention. Robert Tucker, at the time an analyst for the military establishment in the U.S., reflecting on increasing concerns in U.S. business circles, addressed the technical feasibility of seizing Arab oil fields by direct military intervention. This is 1975, Oil, the Issue of American Intervention, in commentary, January 75, quote, "Without intervention, we face the distinct possibility of an economic and political disaster bearing more than a superficial resemblance to the disaster of the 1930s. And he identified a, quote, convenient area as the Arab shoreline of the Gulf, a new El Dorado awaiting its conquistadors, unquote. And he continues, the area that will satisfy our requirements extends from Kuwait down along the coastal region to Qatar. It is this mostly shallow coastal strip less than 400 miles long that provides 40% of OPEC production, 50% of total OPEC reserves, and he continues, it has no substantial centers of population, is without trees, and its effective control by us does not bear remote comparison with the experience of Vietnam, unquote. In 1975, they were preparing for the seizure of oil in the Gulf. Much as we see 9/11 as the opportunity of moment for them to do the same in the Caspian Sea. But in those days, as we discuss in Iraq and Kuwait, in 1975, Harper's Magazine published an analysis called Seizing Arab Oil by a man who was given the name Miles Ignotis, who is in fact Edward Luttwak, a leading CIA and Pentagon DIA functionary who was identified as a Pentagon consultant with intimate links to high-level U.S. policymakers. He set forth in 1975 the blueprint for Operation Desert Shield. We shall develop a rapid deployment and strike scenario. The 82nd Airborne Division, strengthened by air cavalry battalions, will embark on giant C-5 and C-141 jet transports. They will refuel at Israeli bases and drop paratroopers at key Saudi oil fields, installations, and airports. Escort to be provided by Phantom fighters based on Israeli fields and aboard carriers in the Arabian Sea. The Airborne Division will pave way for large marine contingents who will arrive on the scene 72 hours later. And the U.S. National Security Council in 1975 compiled a detailed review of a top-secret Department of Defense plan to invade Saudi Arabian oil fields that was codenamed Dahran Option 4, drawn up by the Pentagon, providing for a U.S. attack on the fields of Ghawar, but they were looking for a pretext. They needed an opportunity to sell it to the public and to people around the world. Lawrence Mosher formulated the plan, circulating, this is now 1979, in Washington corridors, and he disclosed what military people call the U.S. 100,000-man quick strike force, rapidly deployable anywhere in the air, anywhere by air, excuse me, is in place. But as one Pentagon official said, we need a real boogeyman to come in and have to be stopped before we can sell using our quick strike force. It may turn out that the boogeyman will not be defined the same in Arabic as in English, unquote. This is January 19th, 1979. The same methodology, the same type of debate, the same scenario of this ruling class, the same informing of major events of seizing oil, of blood for oil, of massive occupations, of mass destruction. They need a boogeyman. They need someone to demonize. And they demonized Saddam Hussein, the person who was their man in Baghdad for 27 years, the man who was used and run by the CIA station in Baghdad, as it was disclosed in William Evelyn's book, Ropes of Sand, the person who the CIA deployed for the assassination of Abdul Karim Qasim after he nationalized oil and legalized the national parties and the communist parties in the wake of the Iraqi revolution, the man who carried out the torture and the suppression of trade unionists, of village leaders, of the political leadership of the secular, socialist, and nationalist movement of Iraq, hundreds of thousands of lives, over a million people tortured, detained at the behest of U.S. imperialism, their man in Baghdad, Saddam Hussein, the figure who they armed, who they supplied, who they mobilized to try to detach the oil-producing province of Iran after the Iranian Revolution. And that is the figure who now is re-demonized for the pretext of, again, another invasion for the seizure of oil.
So how does Brent Scowcroft and James Baker, and as we can assume, former President George Bush Sr., think George W. Bush, our current president, George Bush Jr., should go about it? What they are saying, basically, is that what he's doing is reckless. And what they propose is approaching the United Nations Security Council, giving it a fig leaf, a veneer of credibility, and in that way building a united response from the major regimes around the world. And what they Brent Scowcroft in the Wall Street Journal states, quote, in any event, we should be pressing the United Nations Security Council to assist on an effective no-notice inspection regime for Iraq, anytime, anywhere, no permission required. And then he goes on. And if he refused, his rejection could provide the persuasive casus belli which many claim we do not now have. And James Baker then repeats it. Quote from James Baker, the United States should advocate the adoption by the United Nations Security Council of a simple and straightforward resolution requiring that Iraq submit to intrusive inspections anytime, anywhere, with no exceptions, and authorizing all necessary means to enforce it. So in other words, Baker is saying, okay, you didn't get the message after Scowcroft laid it out for you. Here it is once again. And this leads, Ralph, to what you discovered about what the U.N. inspections were actually doing.
Well, actually, and I want to discuss precisely that. But before doing so, let me mention James Baker, as the Secretary of State under Bush Sr., is the very figure who enticed Saddam Hussein to rectify the seizure of the southern Iraqi area by the Kuwaiti emir, who had moved his borders 900 square kilometers north until it encompassed the southern tip of the Rumaila oil field, the largest oil field in Iraq and one of the largest in the entire Middle East. At that time, the Kuwaiti emir, who had $2.8 trillion in U.S. and European banks, according to the New York Times, talk about a 200-person feudal family having control of $3 trillion in flight capital. It defines the way in which these client regimes serve world imperialism and our U.S. rulers. At that time, after the emir had seized these additional areas of southern Iraq, the emir bought a company in Alhambra, California, the Santa Fe Drilling Corporation. He spent over $2.4 billion for this company, and he purchased their, quote, slant or horizontal drilling equipment, with which he sucked out about $14 billion of Iraqi oil from the Rumaila oil fields. The principal directors of that company were Brent Scowcroft, the then National Security Advisor of Bush Sr., and Robert Mosbacher, his Secretary of Commerce. And this is the context in which James Baker, their partners in crime, goes to Saddam Hussein and says, you've been done wrong. Rectify your border with Iraq. The areas that just have been taken from you are legitimate areas for you to reoccupy and obtain. They suckered him in. Bush did it, Glasby did it, the then American ambassador, and Baker was explicit in doing it. They looked for the way in which to demonize Saddam Hussein, to provide the pretext, the boogeyman of which they spoke. And now one of the main ways in which they demonize Saddam Hussein is they speak of weapons of mass destruction and of biological warfare that he is supposedly engaged in doing. Well, there was a report by the United States Senate on May 25, 1994, the U.S. chemical and biological warfare-related dual-use exports to Iraq and their impact on the consequences of the Persian Gulf War, a report by Chairman Donald W. Regal, Jr., ranking member of the Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs, in which they document that it was, in fact, the United States, the U.S. government, which sent to Iraq from 1985 through 1989, Bacillus anthracis for production of anthrax, Clostridium botulinum, a source of botulinum toxin, Histoplasma capsulatum, the cause of the disease that attacks lungs, brain, spinal cord, and heart, Brucella melanitensis, the bacteria that damages major organs, Clostridium perfringens, a highly toxic bacterium that produces systemic illness, Clostridium tetani, a highly toxigenic chemical, and Escherichia coli, which destroys human and bacterial DNA, and hundreds of pathogenic biologic agents shipped to Iraq during the 1980s. All of these supplied by the United States, all of these monitored by the American intelligence agencies, all of these biological agents produced in Fort Detrick, all of these biological instruments designed to be used by the Saddam Hussein regime against the Iranian population and, where needed, against resistance from his own populace, a design that was conceived in Washington, directed from Washington, supplied by Washington, and this very Senate committee then reveals that these, quote, microorganisms exported by the United States were identical to those the United Nations inspectors found and removed from the Iraqi biological warfare program, unquote. What does that mean? That the UN inspectors are grabbing the biological instruments and agents supplied by the United States and recapturing them, recovering them, and doing this as a rationale for a sanctions program that has not just destroyed the entire infrastructure of Iraq, but poisoned its water supply, engaged in what has been described as a genocide against the Iraqi population, as was documented by Thomas Nudge, the primary document, Iraq Water Treatment Vulnerabilities, has established that the sanctions were aimed at eliminating a clean water supply, virtually creating epidemics across the entire Iraqi landmass and territory.
With over a million people murdered as a result of these sanctions. It's not even appropriate to say killed. These are people who have been murdered by the U.S.-led sanctions imposed under the auspices of the United Nations. And so now we have Brent Scowcroft and James Baker saying, once again, let us use the United Nations. People, please, brothers and sisters, have no illusions about the United Nations. The remarkable call for anti-war demonstrations being promoted by Ramsey Clark and the International Action Center. It's important to have anti-war demonstrations. It is our move against the war that can put a halt to stopping the invasion. But let us have no illusions. The appeal by Ramsey Clark should not be to the United Nations.
No, actually,
it is the United Nations that is the cover for these invasions and the murder of the Iraqi people.
It reflects what I think may aptly be called the limits of liberalism. To invoke the category of, quote, international law, unquote, or the role of the United Nations, many of the people who have been active in the anti-war movement, from Noam Chomsky to Howard Zinn to Ramsey Clark to Edward Said, have done this. But I have to say that it is no service to the American people to create illusions about the United Nations. It is through the legitimizing of the United Nations that almost all of the major predations of the American rulers have proceeded. The destruction of Palestine took place under the aegis of the United Nations. The murder of Patrice Lumumba was carried out through a United Nations cover for the CIA murder and destruction of the Congolese government and the independence movement in the Congo. The war in Korea was carried out under that rubric. The destruction of Somalia was legitimized by the United Nations sanction. And indeed, the sanctions themselves in Iraq are a United Nations administered operation, as are these inspections. These governments that comprise the member states of the United Nations have the same structures of rule as we in our own country have. It is a ruling class that services American imperialism, that makes these decisions, that controls these peoples, that is in power because of U.S. intelligence, is in fact sustained through the very kinds of operations that we have been describing, and that is why it is no service to our population or to our movement to create illusions about the very instrument that Scowcroft and Kissinger and Albright and Baker are now invoking, whose sanction they are going to obtain to create the consensus they require to carry out their operations in Iraq. We have to keep in mind that the biological weapons program of which they speak is a U.S. program inflicted on the population of Iraq and of Iran, involving the use of the most fiendish weapons against the Iraqi people themselves. The Old World and New World screwworm that destroyed the livestock were biological agents that the American regime introduced into Iraq with a genocidal intent. An epidemic of congenital deformities in those born since 1991 has been documented by Dr. Haifa Asahini, the senior gynecologist at Children's Hospital in southern Iraq. Children born without brains, with giant heads, with stumpy arms, with missing heart valves, with thalidomide-like deformities. A threefold increase in recent years. This is the consequence of the willful biological warfare engaged in by U.S. rulers against the population of Iraq to create the conditions for their seizure of control of the oil reserves of 220 billion barrels in Iraq. It is blood for oil. It is imperial rule. It is mass murder. And its origins are from the United States.
And, Ralph, one of the biological agents that you had not mentioned that the was sent to Iraq from the U.S. AMRID, that is Fort Detrick, was the West Nile virus. And the West Nile virus, until 3 years ago, hadn't appeared in the United States. And as people may have seen in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and in other newspapers, the West Nile virus, this year has 371 people sick in the United States, 16 people have died, and 120 species of animals have been affected, and that the disease is spreading throughout the United States.
Yes,
remember, it hadn't appeared in the Western Hemisphere until 3 years ago.
The numbers were upgraded yesterday, Meyer. There's 452 victims now, and the anticipated spread over 16 states, and now entering California, is reaching epidemic proportions.
Yes, it's in 41 states. It's doubled its known territory this year. And while newspapers like the Los Angeles Times poo-poo the significance of the West Nile virus with a headline, "Panic over virus may exceed the threat," and in some places newspapers are saying more people die of heat stroke and the effects of lack of air conditioning than they do from the West Nile virus, let us say that there, again, there had been, this is a disease that didn't appear in the Western Hemisphere before 3 years, and the type of virus that is appearing is unknown. It is one that is the quote, "new and more virulent strain of the West Nile virus," according to Dwayne Gubler from the National Center for Infectious Diseases in Fort Collins, Colorado. Now, remember, the West Nile virus is a virus that has been under experimentation at Fort Detrick. And as Ralph has mentioned, with clouds of secrecy, yes, go ahead, Ralph.
Well, Maya, yes, I want to. I'm glad you brought up clouds of secrecy and the AMRID and Fort Detrick, because what we can't seem to describe and document sufficiently and frequently enough is that the entire structure of biological warfare and chemical warfare, which has been a touchstone of Pentagon policy, our war crimes tribunal in Vietnam documented the systematic use of biological and chemical and nerve gas and agents, gases that exploded the pupil of the eye. But for 40 years, the Pentagon has carried out germ warfare tests over populated areas of the United States. Leonard A. Cole, who teaches public health policy at Rutgers and who had been part of the Fort Detrick program, in his remarkable book, Clouds of Secrecy, with a foreword by Senator Alan Cranston, documented, as the New York Times acknowledged, the Pentagon's clandestine biological warfare operations, exposing the young, the old, and the medically compromised to infections at 239 sites around the United States. And as Nicholas Wade, the science writer in the New York Times, said, biological weapons, never used in modern warfare, have been introduced in American cities by the Pentagon over a period of decades. And as Paul Warnke, the chief negotiator at SALT, said, Dr. Cole's exhaustively researched book demonstrates that the U.S. government is using the American public as guinea pigs in its biological warfare tests. We're talking, brothers and sisters, about trillions of bacilli, of spores, of bacteria released, of being introduced into the school systems of St. Louis and Minneapolis, the subway system of New York, 87 trillion bacilli in one light bulb. People inhaling a million organisms per minute. 700 trillion organisms released in San Francisco, each with the capacity to multiply a billion fold. This is page 97 of Clouds of Secrecy. This is the murder apparatus which is aimed at our own population. These are the methods through which Our rulers prepare to suppress our own population because, as we've said, the longer you con people, the madder they are when they find it out. This is the nature of ruling class conduct. It informs not only the imperial policy designed to subjugate peoples who are the possessors of resources that the rulers wish to command, but ultimately their great and abiding fear is that sleeping giant, the working class, the mass of the population in the United States. And we will discuss on, as we had hoped to in this program, but will next, the urban warfare, which has been prepared not only for wars in Iraq, but for cities across the United States. A urban warfare involving the occupation of American cities, the detention of masses of American citizens, and the imposition of forms of military rule, the complement to the U.S. rulers' designs abroad, whether it be Bush Jr., Bush Sr., Clinton, Carter, Reagan, or whomever. The apparatus of the ruling class sustains its hegemony over our society by these methods, by these means, by these policies, by these crimes.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We'll be with you next week. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net. Again, that's Taking Aim at PacBell, PACBELL.net.
As WBAI moves into the home stretch of our fiscal year, we thank all the listeners who became members of the station in record numbers during our August Summer Fund membership drive. This is Valerie Venice, the General Manager of WBAI, inviting you to join us for a report to the listeners on Wednesday, August 28th at 8 a.m. We have lots to discuss about the promises made, the work done, and the road ahead for this beloved institution in community broadcasting. So join us Wednesday, August 28th at 8 a.m. for the WBAI Report to the Listeners. And once again, our many thanks.
This is Marion Borenstein, co-chairman of the WBAI Local Advisory Board. The WBAI Local Advisory Board meetings are held monthly. For time and location, call our new voicemail number, 212-209-29.